From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. On this second installment of a two-part series examining prospects for Democrats and Republicans in the 2018 U.S. midterm elections, we turn now to a Republican strategist. We spoke last week to Democratic strategist Will Marshall from the Progressive Policy Institute, who is optimistic about chances for his minority party to capture a number of seats in the House of Representatives, currently controlled by Republicans. However, some Republican strategists are cautiously optimistic that they may still be able to prevail, if not in the lower chamber, the House of Representatives, at least in the upper chamber or the Senate. As we said in our program last week, Republicans presently control all levers of political power, the White House and both chambers of Congress. Nonetheless, polls indicate a degree of voter dissatisfaction with the Republican Party, as well as with U.S. President Donald Trump. Historically, the party in power does tend to lose seats in midterm elections. Many political analysts suggest that even though President Trump is not on the ballot, the midterms will be a referendum on his performance over the last 2 years. Can Republicans retain control of the House of Representatives and or the Senate? At least 48 Republican members have already headed for the exits, decided to retire, or announced they will not seek re-election this year, as a sign they are concerned about being defeated by Democrats. However, in recent days, some Republican lawmakers have voiced optimism in the wake of the recent confirmation of Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court. They believe it may energize Republican voters ahead of the midterms. Other analysts say there may be a price to pay for Republicans for elevating someone who polls indicate is rather unpopular with even a large segment of Republican women to the Supreme Court. Our special guest on this edition of the program is Tim Chapman. He's executive director of Heritage Action for America. That's a conservative policy advocacy organization affiliated with the Heritage Foundation, a conservative think tank based here in Washington. Chapman is an original co-founder of Heritage Action, serving first as its chief operating officer. As executive director, he is responsible for establishing a long-term strategic vision for Heritage America and working with the Heritage Foundation leadership to ensure both organizations are pursuing common goals. Previously, Tim Chapman served as senior communications advisor to former U.S. Senator Jim DeMint. He has been published and quoted in various outlets, including The Hill, The Washington Post, National Review, and Forbes, and has made many appearances on cable television. And Tim Chapman, who will help us understand the Republican strategy in the run-up to the midterm elections, joins us here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Tim Chapman, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
So let's get right into our topic. But first, Tim, talk about Heritage Action for America, its purpose. What are your goals, particularly in relation to the upcoming midterm elections?
Sure. Heritage Action for America was founded in 2010. The Heritage Foundation, as you know, was founded in 1973. For a long time, the Heritage Foundation had been pounding the pavement on Capitol Hill and advocating for different policy positions. I was there in 2010 when we did this. We decided we needed a sister organization that had more capacity to get involved politically. And so we started a 501c4 nonprofit sister organization. And so we lobby, we advocate, and we get involved in politics at the grassroots level. And then this year, we've actually taken a new step for our organization. We've never before backed candidates for federal office, but this year we've gotten involved in the midterm elections because we think the midterm elections are pretty critical for the future of the country and for the future policy fights that we want to win in the Heritage Foundation. So we're getting involved in more than a dozen races across the country right now and doing our best to defend conservative candidates who are under attack from the left.
Well, let's talk about that. In the so-called year of the Democrat, mm-hmm. where many are projecting that the Democrats could potentially take over the House of Representatives, what exactly is your overarching strategy, or are you looking more at specific races and have a specific micro-strategy for each one? And secondly, of course, how do you see the prospects of Republicans remaining in control of particularly the House of Representatives?
Yeah. You know, I think there's really two parallel universes going on right now in these midterm elections. The first universe is one where it's a war of attrition at the local level in district by district races. And that universe is one where you're talking about candidate X versus candidate Z and how they stand on the issues and what's specifically happening locally in that district. And then the second parallel universe is one that is a national conversation about the future of the country and a conversation about what we're seeing take place at the highest level and the highest, most dramatic stages of American politics. And I think what we are trying to do is we are trying to be a part of both of those. I think that we are clearly involved at the local race-by-race stage where we are going into specific districts and we are running the numbers and we are showing what is happening in these specific districts as a result of things like the deregulatory program this administration has put in place, as a result of the tax law that has been put in place. We're showing what the returns actually look like for an average family of middle-class family of four in the district, average single filers in the district. We're showing what's happening in terms of wages, job growth, that kind of thing. But then I think we also need to make sure that we are not ignoring the national conversation that's happening. And if you can, in a district, make the case that, hey, this is good for, you know, Andy Barr's district in Kentucky, and I think that case is very much there to be made, but then marry that with a conversation about what it is that the left actually wants if they are able to regain control of the House and potentially the Senate, and what might happen over the next 2 years if that were to happen, that more national conversation. That's what I think the strategy has to be. You can't ignore one or the other. You have to be involved in both.
Of course, and I use the word left, I guess, to refer to Democrats. And
right.
Our previous guest, Will Marshall, might take exception to that. His organization represents much more centrist Democrats. So They call themselves a big tent party, and so forth. Nonetheless, let's take a look at the challenges facing Republicans. Tim Chapman, as we said earlier, so many Republican members of Congress are heading for the exits, retiring, not seeking reelection. There must be a reason for that. They're concerned perhaps about the underwhelming poll numbers for President Trump. Do you see this election as, in fact, sort of a referendum on President Trump? And notwithstanding some positive consequences of policies, some are concerned in the Republican Party, even about the impact of the tax reform legislation and other policies, tariffs, which were meant to help steel workers and other American manufacturers, which aren't really having those effects that were intended.
Yeah. I mean, I think this is part of what I was talking about a moment ago. I mean, yes, at the national level, what the Democratic Party has tried to do is make this a referendum on President Trump's personality, on his Twitter handle, on the dramatic day-to-day things that we see in terms of staff happenings in the White House and things like that. And I think they've been more successful than I would like to see at doing that. And I think that that has made it harder for a lot of Republican candidates to do well in their districts. But that said, I think that's why you have to convince these candidates that there's nothing to run away from here. When you peel back all of the day-to-day media and news coverage, and then you actually look at the results, and you actually look at what's been happening in terms of the economy, what's been happening in terms of foreign policy, and how the White House is actually accomplishing things, I think that that's where you get to a place where you can begin to say, there's nothing to run away from here. And you should be nationalizing it in that respect. I mean, I think that a lot of these candidates are beginning to embrace that. And so, for example, the president is hitting the campaign trail, and he's getting out there now. And there was an open question for a while as to whether he would go into districts like the district in Kentucky where Andy Barr is fighting against McGrath in that race.
Now, Andy Barr being the Republican.
Andy Barr's the Republican, McGrath's a Democrat. And so there was an open question there because people were saying, oh, I'm not sure, you know, maybe the president doesn't do well with, you know, soccer moms in the district or what it is. But I think that they're all beginning to see that, you know what, the president actually brings a lot to the table when he can come into a district and focus the district on what is actually happening on the ground there. And so I view that as a positive indicator that a lot of these races are now going to be helped by the administration coming into them. Now, he's not going to help in every single race. You know, there are races, some races where the demographics of the districts are such that it probably wouldn't be smart. And so I think the White House will be very strategic about where they deploy the president and deploy him in areas where he can be most beneficial. But I think the fact that he's getting out there onto the campaign trail shows that there's enough confidence in the Republican Party right now in the overall story that they have to tell of success when you look at the economy, when you look at deregulation, when you look at what's happening in foreign policy, and then when you look at what's happening in terms of being able to put two justices on the Supreme Court, there is more excitement now than there was a few weeks ago. People are excited about that message.
I want to pick up on something you said. You referred to foreign policy, successes in foreign policy, and of course we have a large international audience. I'd like you to elaborate on what you see as these foreign policy successes and to what extent that could play into the midterms, if at all.
So I think the NAFTA remake that just was accomplished, I think that was a pretty significant deal that the president was able to secure. And I think when you look back even as much as a few weeks ago, you know, just thinking about that, people were criticizing the president for the way that he was treating Canadian prime minister. People were criticizing the president for his relationships with the Mexican leadership. And yet here we are with a completely remade NAFTA, and one that I think will benefit American workers tremendously. And so to that effect, I think that helps the president and the president's party in the midterm elections. And then I think you look at what's happening potentially in North Korea. The jury is still out on how that is resolved, but there have been steps towards progress and there have been steps backwards as well. We have to keep an eye on that, but I think that's a pretty big win for the administration if it continues to go in the right direction. So I just think that people are underestimating what is being accomplished in terms of working with foreign allies and working to get a better deal for Americans.
Well, we'll have more in just a moment, but first, you're listening to Press Conference USA on The Voice of America. Our guest on this edition of a two-part series examining Democratic and Republican prospects in the upcoming U.S. midterm congressional elections is Tim Chapman. He's Executive Director of Heritage Action for America, and that's a conservative policy advocacy organization affiliated with the Heritage Foundation, a think tank based here in Washington. We're discussing Republican prospects as we approach the November congressional elections in the United States. I'm Carol Castiel. This is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website. You can follow us on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. Well, here's a shout out to a Twitter fan, Zach Waku from Abuja, Nigeria. If you want to hear your name on the air, please give us feedback on our show by sending an email to pcusa@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page and follow us on Twitter. Well, back to our special guest, Tim Chapman, with whom we're talking about Republican strategy for the midterm elections. Well, Tim, I want to pick up on something you said before our break regarding foreign policy, trade, the Republican Party writ large. Is it now Trump's party? And the reason I ask you that is because Mr. Trump has famously been very skeptical about free trade, trade agreements, not perhaps as concerned about fiscal discipline, all hallmarks of what we used to associate with the Republican Party. We're seeing more protectionist policies with respect to the tariffs, rising deficits, notwithstanding some positive aspects of the tax reform legislation you alluded to. Is Heritage in particular, or Heritage Action, your group, concerned about this shift in traditional Republican philosophy at all?
Yes. Yes, we are. I mean, Heritage Foundation has always been pro-free trade. Heritage Action has always worked with the Heritage Foundation to accomplish that. I'd say a couple things about this. One, I think if we're still talking about a trade war with China a year from now, then that's a different scenario than what we're talking about right now. And I think there will be significant negative repercussions for the American economy. But I think I am inclined to give this president the benefit of the doubt as he tries to seek to curb some of the excesses of what China has been doing to the United States, whether it's currency manipulation or intellectual property theft or whatever the different tactics they've been using are. And so I think that something has to be done, and the president has been pretty determined to do that. And so I'm inclined to give him the benefit of the doubt, even though the tactics that he's using are not the tactics that we would necessarily suggest that he use. That said, the broader question about whether or not this is the president's party, I think right now there is no doubt this president is tremendously popular with the base of this party. And he holds tremendous sway, has a very durable base. And so I think in many ways it is his party. And I think that he also deserves tremendous amounts of credit. Go back to 2015 and 2016 when we were having a primary for the Republican nomination. He deserves tremendous amounts of credit for identifying that there was an entire group of Americans who could become Republican voters who had heretofore not been Republican voters. And the policies that attracted them to this president were the policies that he talked about to seek to strengthen the working class. And that working class voter is now becoming a critical part of the Republican coalition. And so the president deserves a lot of credit for that and is making a lot of us who have been in the conservative movement for decades think more critically about how to make sure our policies are crafted in such a way that the working class voter is not left out of our solutions. And so to that extent, I think the president deserves a lot of credit for getting people to think again.
Tim Chapman, let me pick up on that and ask you, what about women voters and some of the minorities who are perhaps more likely to vote Democratic, but not totally, because there are many women Republicans? Are you concerned about losing some of these female Republicans, given some of the rhetoric which is seen as, one could say, unseemly by the president, some of the policies, too, that they feel could adversely impact them?
Yeah.
And we'll get to the Supreme Court confirmation of Brett Kavanaugh in just a moment. But what about those voters?
Sure. When you're talking about minority voters and female voters, I think the message that this party has to deliver is one of results. If you look at the African-American vote right now, this is historically high approval rating for a Republican president in the African-American community. I mean, it's still very low, but it is historically high for a Republican president. And then you look at what's happening with the unemployment rate in the African-American community, which has never been higher. And so there are real results that are being delivered. And there are some inroads that this administration is making that are very interesting, whether it be Kanye West or whether it be the work that he's doing on prison reform and sentencing reform and things like that. I mean, there's some inroads that he's making that are making people think twice in the African-American community about what this party is doing. And it's a good thing for the party. And then I would say on the female vote, I think it's the exact same thing. I think the argument there is it's okay if you disagree with the way the president uses Twitter. It's okay if you don't like the way that he phrases things sometimes. But is your family better off? Is your community better off? Is your community ultimately growing and experiencing prosperity? And so for moms or wives or single women who are working class, this is a big deal. And you have to be able to separate all the noise from the results.
So let's now turn to the Brett Kavanaugh confirmation to the Supreme Court. Has the Kavanaugh confirmation fight had an impact on Trump voters, in your view, and Republicans writ large heading for the midterms?
Yes. I mean, it was one of those seminal moments in American politics that really galvanized the Republican Party. I think it galvanized the Democratic Party as well. But the Republican Party, I think, before the Kavanaugh hearings, we were dealing with a kind of, I would describe it as a general apathy on the part of Republican voters. And I think that existed for a couple reasons. One, I think that a lot of Republican voters just don't believe the polls. They don't believe the press. They think that the talk of a, you know, blue wave is not true because the press and the polls got it all wrong in 2016. So they're probably going to get it wrong in 2018. I think that's dangerous if that's what you think. I think you need to really be taking the polling seriously. But there are real signs that this is a dangerous midterm election for Republicans. So there was apathy on that part. And then there was apathy, I think, just in that the general base voter had come off a 2016 election where they laid it all on the line and really were just taking a breather. And then along comes Kavanaugh, and the first week is rather anticlimactic, but then we have the accusations that come forward. And this woke up a lot of Republican base voters because there's something very deep going on here. And that is that for the better part of four, five, six decades, Republicans, conservatives in this country have been embarking on a project to remake the federal court and to remake the Supreme Court in such a way that the court would be more humble and that it would not make big cultural decisions at the federal court level, and it would send those decisions back to states and Congress. The Republican base voters have known that the Democrats and liberals in this country have been successful in using the court to kind of end run state legislatures and Congress. And the base voter has viewed that as them sidestepping the Constitution. And so this is very deep. And so you had that going on. And then you had what Republican voters perceived as a Democratic Party so bent on retaining power on the court that they would do something as crazy as hijack the Me Too movement to take somebody out. And the Me Too movement was something that this was a bipartisan movement, and a lot of Republicans were completely supportive of it, and I think still are, because the Me Too movement has been something that has properly identified a serious problem and has properly held powerful men in this country accountable. And that's a good thing. But then our base saw the Democratic Party hijack that for a political purpose and to destroy somebody's entire reputation. And when they saw that happen, it woke them up and it made people very angry. And it wasn't just men that it made angry. The people that I talk to who are most angry about this are Republican women, because they view it as, like I said, a hijacking of something that is good and should be above politics. And then it was used in politics to destroy somebody and to destroy a family and to hurt that family, all for the purpose of what I was talking about earlier, which is to retain the power that they've held on the Supreme Court, which the base voter, the conservative movement, does not view as a proper constitutional power for them to have anyway. So this is very deep.
Now, just to be fair, just add a little balance to what you just said. Democrats might say that the Republicans were bent on retaining power of the court, which is why they held up Judge Merrick Garland's nomination back in the Obama administration, didn't even provide a hearing for him. So that was their way of, that is Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, way of saying, well, if we get a Republican president, you know, we'll just put our people on the court. So let's just be a little bit fair. The other thing is I don't think, not speaking on behalf of Democrats, but just as a neutral voice, I don't think Democrats were certainly bent on destroying anybody's reputation, Brett Kavanaugh. There was concern about accusations or allegations of sexual assault, and that would be very serious. But I don't think it was anything deliberate. Now, let me say, conversely to what you just said about Republican women, what about concerns that the Kavanaugh fight would actually rev up women voters, particularly on behalf of Democrats in November, voters who were already motivated?
Yeah.
Okay, so in other words, it could help the Democrats just as much as you said it could potentially help Republicans in the midterms.
A couple things on that. It was interesting to see recently Chuck Grassley, who's the chairman of the Judiciary Committee, come out and say that if Trump were to nominate someone in 2020 going into the presidential election, that if he's chairman, he will not schedule a hearing for that person based on the Merrick Garland precedent. So I think there are people in the Republican Party who are trying to be consistent with what they said and did. With respect to how this is playing in politics with women, Democratic women who were really animated to vote this midterm, I think were already at a peak. There's no doubt that this has animated them more, but I don't think you're going to see a difference in numbers. I think that the big issue here was that we looked at polling that showed that in most of these districts, there was a massive intensity gap, and the intensity gap was in favor of the Democrats, and it was always ranging from 8 points to 12 points. Well, now we're seeing that intensity gap completely close. So now it's going to be about voter turnout. It's good for the Republican Party to have at least an engagement level that's similar to that of the Democratic Party. Big picture, I think we should be concerned about it for the country, the fact that both sides are so intense and so animated, and we are really more divided than we ever have been. But if you're just looking at this on politics, it's a good thing for the midterm elections for the Republican Party to have closed that intensity gap.
What happens if Republicans lose control of one or both chambers of Congress next month? Would it help or hurt President Trump's reelection hopes, in your view, for 2020?
There's some interesting schools of thought on that. Some people suggest that if Nancy Pelosi were Speaker of the House, it would give Donald Trump a foil, and it would be something that would probably help him in his 2020 reelection. I can certainly see some validity in that. That said, you don't win by losing. If you lose, you lose. And so there may be a silver lining in losing, but for the Republican Party, losing means 2 years of potential legislative advancement gone. that hurts for the party because you don't get windows like this very often in American politics. And there's no guarantee that you get another window 2020 to 2022. So I think for the president, I don't think anybody should be thinking that if you lose one or both houses, that there's any way that this is better for him. There may be some silver linings, and there's no doubt that if that happens, that some of that dynamic will be there. But I think in general, it's probably not good.
What would you say is the top issue in this year's midterm campaign?
For which voter, right? I think the top issue for the Democratic Party is Donald Trump. And I don't think it's an issue. It's Donald Trump. They're still reeling from losing the 2016 election. They don't like Trump at all. The anger is there towards the president. And so that is the motivating factor for the left to come out to put Trump in check and to try to then take the House back, hopefully the Senate for them, and then to use the House and the Senate to do 2 years of really tough investigations, 2 years of subpoenas, 2 years of massive gridlock where they are doing what their base voter wants them to do, which is to hold Trump accountable. I think that's the top election. I think on the Republican side, this is one of the things that we struggle with, is that there are multiple issues. And I talked earlier about the two parallel universes. You know, in the parallel universe where it's the local war of attrition, in a district by district race, it's about the economy. It's about what's happening in that district. It's about wages in that district. It's about bonuses in the district. And it's about whether or not things are getting better. But in the other universe, there is also like just the conservative base voter that I was describing as having been so animated by the Kavanaugh hearings. That universe is one about pushing back against what they see as a progressive left that wants to upend everything that they feel like they've secured through winning the 2016 election.
Now, you said that for Democrats, President Trump is the central issue in trying to combat his policies and try to hold him accountable, provide more oversight. In the end, whether it's Mr. Trump or other issues, health care, the economy, and some would say the perhaps disproportionate windfall from the tax reform legislation to wealthier Americans, we'll see as time goes on. But either way, is the fact that President Trump is central to the midterms, is that good or bad for Republicans in your view?
It depends on the district.
Okay.
It really does depend on the
district. You're very nuanced.
And, you know, I think on balance, it's good because you need engagement at the base level because this base is with their president. But in some districts, it doesn't make a lot of sense to have the president be front and center. But in most of these battlegrounds where we're engaging, you know, and I just looked through the 13 races that we're in right now, and I think in at least potentially all of them, but in no doubt in 9 or 10 of them, it makes a lot of sense for the president to be there and to be helping.
So in those races, you're saying that they're very tight.
Yes.
Democrats are giving Republicans a run for their money, but you're going to deploy President Trump and—
And in those races, we are doing the dual track. We are doing, one, we have to wake up our base voter. That's happening. And Trump really helps with that. And he helps crystallize what's at stake in terms of the national narrative. But then we are also doing a very strategic kind of rollout of direct mail in those districts, of digital advertising in those districts, and of advertising on cable and broadcast. We're not talking about the president in those ads. What we're talking about is very clear data as to what's changed in the district since the enactment of the tax law and since the president has done the deregulatory efforts. And we're able to show in a very clear way in those districts that it's getting a lot better. And I think that's the important thing. You mentioned whether it was a disproportionate windfall for corporate America versus individuals. I think that that's the biggest threat that Republicans have when trying to defend the tax cuts. You have to make the argument that because this manufacturing plant, which is a corporation in your company, did get significant returns, you have to then make the argument how that's trickling down. And so it is a harder argument to make because it's not just 1 + 1 = 2, but it's there to be made. I think what we do well is try to make that policy argument and try to show what's happening in the district. So it's statistical and then it's also anecdotal. And then you're layering on top of that what is happening in the local economy because of the corporate rate cuts.
Well, Tim Chapman is Executive Director of Heritage Action. That's a conservative policy advocacy organization affiliated with the Heritage Foundation here in Washington. Tim Chapman, thanks so much for coming in, sharing your insights on the Republican strategy in the run-up to the 2018 midterm elections.
Thank you for having me.
Press Conference USA on The Voice of America was produced in Washington. Our engineer was Joe Gill, and I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on The Voice of America.